May it please the Court, Thomas Hungar for Plaintiff's Appellants. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, this is a straightforward APA case. The agency completely failed to respond to comments showing that its decision violated the very criteria it said it was applying, and the resulting guidelines are contrary to law. Desperate to avoid any adjudication of these fatal flaws in the guidelines, the government argues that they are immune from judicial review because no one has standing to challenge them. We submit that that argument is clearly wrong under this Court's precedents, which unquestionably confer standing on parties like plaintiffs who now face new direct competitors as a result of the agency's action. The District Court offered 3 reasons for dismissal, but each of them is foreclosed by precedent. First, the District Court held that the competitor standing cases apply only to participants in regulated economic markets, not applicants for research grants.
We crossed that bridge in the political case.
Yes, Your Honor. Exactly right.
So what's your next point?
Well, the government and the District Court argue that plaintiffs lack standing because the guidelines will not, quote, almost surely cause the plaintiffs to lose funding, close quote. But that is not the correct test under this Court's precedents. Both the District Court and the government rely on dictum from the El Paso case, but that case involved a potential competitor, not an actual competitor, as is the case here. And this Court's formulation of the test in cases involving actual competitors have been quite consistent. In Shays, for instance, as Your Honor mentioned, the Court said, quote, accounting for additional rivals constitutes injury in fact, close quote. And there are multiple cases, Louisiana Energy and others cited in our brief, for the same proposition. There's no question that Dr. Shirley here is suffering from the effects of that additional competition that the agency guidelines have permitted to occur. This Court's cases make clear that such increased competition constitutes injury in fact. As the Court said in Shays, regulated litigants suffer legal injury when agencies set the rules of the game in violation of statutory directives. And that's exactly what is going on here. Dr. Shirley is being forced to compete in an arena that is tainted by the presence of illegal competitors whose entry has been facilitated and encouraged by the guidelines that are being challenged.
Mr. Hungar, the government's position in part is that the connection between that new competition and any harm to the plaintiff is tenuous. And they say that in large part because, as I understand the argument, because there's this sorting, initial sorting into the sheep and the goats, and only the top half get then evaluated in competition with each other. Looking at 185 in the joint appendix, which is the declaration of Sarah Jean Rocky, PhD, I think that is she your witness?
Yes.
She says at page 185, paragraph 10, in addition, CSR assigns the application to a scientific review group that conducts the first level of peer review within CSR or an IC. Now, if the first level of peer review here is this 50-50 sorting, that leaves me wondering, well, where exactly does it take place? Is it in the CSR or the IC, or does it vary?
Well, my understanding is that
the institutes, yeah.
My understanding is that certainly the usual course is that it is assigned to an institute or center or more than one, and at that point the sorting takes place. The declaration also says it can happen at CSR. I'm not aware of any instances, but the government.
So your understanding, your interpretation says the weight of this is at the IC, at
yes.
this particular institute.
Yes, and for instance,
so that when they're farmed out to the institutes, they're not. It's not selective. Everything goes to whichever is the appropriate institute.
Correct.
And then the institute does the first half, or 50-50 screening.
Correct.
And then looks at the closely at the others. Okay.
But the important point is that even in that first step, they're doing a comparative analysis. They're looking at each of these research applications, at the range of research applications that have been submitted for that particular round of considerations, and they're ranking them. Are you in the top half or the bottom half? So even at that stage, there is competition occurring, and obviously if you're determining who's in the top half is affected by who's in the pool. And if you have a bunch of embryonic...
Right, but what do you make of the argument that the pool expands because if there are more competitors now allowed in, 0.5 of N is larger than it was before?
Well, that's true, but it's still... The bottom half is larger also. That is for the non-embryonic stem cell researcher, there is a less chance of being in the top half. And then similarly, if they are in the top half, there's a less chance of being funded.
I'm not sure that's right. It seems to me ex ante, the chance is the same. Suppose the human adult stem cell researchers are the only ones to submit at time one, okay, and there are 100 applications and 50 will be sent to the second level. Now the embryonic stem cell people come in, and there are 200 applications. Okay? Now 100 of them will be sent to the next level. And the ex ante, the chances are 0.5 in either case.
Well, the problem, though, there are two responses. First of all, Your Honor, remember that the agency has indicated its special interest in ensuring embryonic stem cell research is being funded. They have announced that they think, as we indicated at page 8 of our reply brief, they have a statement on their website written by we don't who, but someone at the agency indicating that they think this embryonic stem cell research has special value, special potential. And moreover, embryonic and adult stem cell research are uniquely in competition with each other for the research dollars because of the fact that they do, or in the case of embryonic stem cell research, it's hoped that they will do the same types of things. They both focus on cellular cures or treatments that will allow remediating damaged tissue or replacing tissue that has been destroyed or is not functioning properly, producing new cells, essentially, to replace those that are not working.
So numbers might be equal, but there's a thumb on the scale.
Exactly, Your Honor. If the court has no further questions, I'd like to...
By the way, I'm assuming, but I'm not sure how much foundation there is yet in the record on that. I'm not sure yet with how much foundation there is, that the funding available for this pool of applications, including both human and adult and embryonic stem cells, is in any given point fixed.
That's correct, and the record does reveal that. We've alleged it in our complaint, and I believe Dr. Rocky's declaration, actually.
By congressional appropriation?
Correct. Then it's divided.
Is it year-by-year appropriation?
Yes, and it goes to the individual centers. In fact, the appropriations...
Institutes?
Institutes and centers, yes, Your Honor.
If we agree with you on standing, should we send it back? Or should we... why should we proceed any further?
Well, I think certainly the court has discretion to proceed, but obviously it's not required to proceed further. In the interest of judicial economy, if the court agrees with us on standing, the merits have been briefed. The government, in fact, has suggested the court could reach the merits. And so we think it would be appropriate to at least to provide guidance to the district court to reach at least the likelihood of success prong, if not the other more discretionary aspects that the district court has not addressed.
Referring to a motion for summary affirmance? When you say the government's...
No, in their brief, they go on to brief the merits in response to our briefing of the merits, and they suggest that the court could reach the merits, in their view, in order to affirm the denial of preliminary relief, obviously, in our view, for the opposite result, or at least to provide guidance to the district court on remand.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. I'm Stephanie Marcus from the Department of Justice, and I represent defendants appellees. Here, the district court was correct in holding that Dr. Shirley and Dr. Deischer lack standing. Their allegations of injury are far too speculative to support injury in fact under Article 3.
Are they more speculative than other competitor cases?
Yes, they are, Your Honor. In the two categories that have been cited by plaintiffs, the competitors' standing cases in economic markets. In all of those cases, there was a virtual certainty that the plaintiff would either lose sales or suffer or have to decrease prices or change its behavior somehow in response to not only additional competition, but also in regulatory agencies treating competitors differently. Allowing, for example, in the Louisiana Energy case, for market rates to be charged by a competitor. In the Shays case, which you mentioned, Your Honor, which is a political case and not an economic market case, it's entirely distinguishable as well, because you're talking about an election where the plaintiffs are candidates and they're going to face direct competition from an opponent who can benefit from FEC rules that the candidates allege do not enforce federal election law and would allow their opponents to use soft money or do certain types of advertising. And again, that is going to have an effect on an election campaign. Here, in contrast, you don't have any kind of allegations like that. There's nothing that Dr. Shirley or Dr. Deischer would have to do differently in response to the NIH guidelines.
They might, you mentioned losing sales. They might lose funding, which is part of their livelihood, because there's a fixed pot of money. And if there are more people competing for that money illegally, we assume for these purposes, competing for this money, then that means they're less likely to get the grants themselves, right?
Well, actually, their mere allegations that they, you know, the allegation of the complaint here is just that that it will result in increased competition. That's not sufficient. There needs to be, that allegation standing alone needs to be supported by some showing that it actually will work competitive harm on them. And here, because of
how would you make that showing?
Well, here, I think you, because of the structure of the NIH process, it is at this stage they can't make that showing.
So it's impossible for
at this stage. I mean, there.
Well, this is the threshold. So you're saying this, if you can't make it here, they can't make it anywhere. It's like New York.
Well, I think, Your Honor, I mean, one point, for example, if NIH and its guidelines had said, we are now going to devote 90% of our funding from Congress. Congress fixes funding for NIH. Congress does not fix what amount of funding goes to the different types of research. If NIH were to have said, we are now going to do, you know, 90% of our funding or even 50% of our funding, but it's done on an application by application basis, and
but wait a minute. The 50% is kind of what they are saying at the screening stage, right? 50% will get forwarded to stage two.
Oh, right. No, I was saying if what you don't have here is any showing that a researcher doing adult stem cell research will face any lower odds than they otherwise would, absent the guidelines.
There's a fixed pot of money.
Yes.
And there used to be, in my hypothetical, 100 adult stem cell applications competing for that fixed pot, right? Okay. Now there are 200, half of them embryonic, half of them adult. How can we say that there isn't a competitive harm to the parties that used to have exclusive purchase on that money?
I think at this point it is too speculative to say if your hypothetical would even turn out to be correct, because as you pointed out, in the first level of screening, which is the first level where an application goes forward, if the top half go to the second tier of review, you're going to have more people make it to the second tier of review if you have more applications. It's
well, that,
only
that part yes. is disputed only, I think, to the extent that Mr. Hunger suggests there's a thumb on the scale. But let's go on with your point
right.
to the and second
then,
stage.
And then the other point is, as the affidavit makes clear, is that there are 24 different institutes and centers. And plaintiffs have made no showing at all. In fact, Dr. Deischer hasn't even submitted an application. She just says she's in the process of applying. And Dr. Shirley hasn't shown that any application of his is actually in competition at the second tier of the application process. And so to say at this point just...
Well, what about his 28J letter?
His 28J letter actually... Well, two responses to that, Your Honor. First of all, you need to show standing at the outset of the litigation. So it's what happens after the complaint is filed is legally irrelevant to whether the district court was correct in dismissing for lack of standing.
This particular one, yes, it might be illustrative, though, of how these things
work. Yes, Your Honor. And to respond to that, in this particular 28J letter, he is saying that his application was rejected at that first tier.
Well, I'm looking at the second paragraph in which his application newly submitted.
Oh, the newly submitted
right.
one, not the
one. He says in direct competition with one using embryonic stem cells.
Well, that is entirely, you know, the agency has no reason to believe that that is correct, and it actually is belied by the affidavit that's actually in the record of this case and how the process works. You wouldn't have a chief competitor under that process. You submit your application. The agency decides where it goes, and you know,
I understand that. But this is not as of the time of the filing, but maybe it's right. Illustrative. He says he applied for a grant to do research with human adult stem cells to create a human liver surrogate for drug evaluation purposes. Okay, and that there's another grant application that would use embryonic stem cells for similar research. Okay, so. There, before they would be in front of the same institute.
We don't know that because we don't even know if there is that. You know, you just have that in the letter, but there's no evidence that that company has submitted an application. And
that's because it's the letter's post hoc, the filing.
Right. I would like to direct your attention to Joint Appendix 187 again, where in the same affidavit. From NIH, there are funding estimates for.
I think this is plaintiff's declaration, isn't it?
No, it's defendant's.
Sarah Jean Rocky?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, then when I spoke with your colleague on for the plaintiffs, I was mistaken. That was not his.
Right.
Mistaken as well. That was not his witness. That was yours saying.
In opposition to the plaintiff.
Creating this ambiguity about whether things go to CSR or IC for the first cut.
Well, I think that, Your Honor, it says that, in addition, CSR assigns the application to a scientific review group that conducts the first level of peer review within CSR or an IC. It depends on the type. There are different types of grant applications, as I understand it. You can have a program grant application, and depending, you know, on the type of grant you're asking for, it may be done by CSR, it may be done by the IC. Yet another uncertainty in the process about which grants would go
where.
Well,
but the point that's relevant as far as your observation about the 50-50 screening, right, that creates new opportunities, is that that might take place at the institute level where they're more likely in head-to-head competition.
Well,
because
I'm not
they've
sure
already
that
been,
would follow.
A subset has been selected and sent to the institute for whatever. The NCI, say, because they both deal with similar research.
Well, right. the as we pointed out in our brief, that adult stem cell research and embryonic stem cell research aren't always being done to try to find new treatments or therapies for the same types of diseases. So
the example we just gave had to do with assisting in drug evaluation, for instance.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that they wouldn't be sent to the same institute or center, but they might not. I mean, some, you know, they range from cancer treatments to Parkinson's disease to ALS. I mean, there are all sorts of different potential uses. So,
but there's some overlap.
There could be some overlap, and could be some overlap in the competition in the sense that you could have someone who was doing adult stem cell research who is now going to try embryonic stem cell research, and that's the same person who might have been in more in direct competition before the guidelines.
I'm
sorry.
Judge Brown, another question.
All right. Yes. I'm back on this JA 185.
Yes.
If I understand what paragraph 11 is saying, it's saying that even though there's this 50% cutoff, they could always make exceptions if there's a motion by a reviewer, right? Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, because this is you're right, Your Honor, and that would be an exception, but it says application scoring may also be considered, yes, so that's still a possibility.
But if you can do that, then they are in competition, aren't they?
Well, I mean, again, it's there, as the rest of the paragraph shows, there are so many different questions and criteria being asked that there is a possibility for competition, yes, but that is not enough to support Article III standing. You need to show some kind of imminent injury. And in other competitor standing cases, the plaintiffs have had to change their behavior, have had to spend more money to compete with either another political candidate or with an economic competitor in the marketplace.
That was true. I thought some of the cases were just where the agency loosened regulations on a competitor.
Well,
so it's kind of a bank shot effect into how it affects you. You're saying, well, because my competitor isn't being regulated as heavily as I think the law requires, that's going to give them a leg up in the competition. But that's not a direct, you know, it doesn't force you to go out and spend more money. It doesn't immediately cause you to lose sales. You can certainly adjust your own behavior to compete more forcefully.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but under there you have cases where the law of economics would show that they're having another competitor in the marketplace, particularly if they're not regulated as heavily as, you know, maybe your company, is going to cause you can change your behavior, you can spend more on advertising, but that causes you a financial injury. It also causes...
But if you do nothing, it's speculative as to whether you'll lose any sales because unless the products are identical.
Well, right? Your Honor, I think in the cases in which standing has been recognized, it hasn't been speculative about loss of sales. In fact, in Associated Gas Distributors versus FERC, one of the main cases relied on by plaintiffs, there was one of the local distribution companies had already been bypassed by an allegedly illegal transaction. I mean, something had already happened there. And in another case, as I mentioned in the Louisiana case, there was a competitor that was being allowed to charge market prices, which then would, you know, lead to, maybe it wouldn't necessarily lead to, you know, predatory pricing, but it would lead to lower prices, a decrease in prices. And in a First Circuit case about milk pricing, the court noted that the plaintiffs had submitted an affidavit from an expert in dairy economics. I mean, there's just nothing analogous here. And in fact,
those are good examples, but that's not the universe of our competitive standing cases. We have ones that are much more attenuated than that.
But Your Honor, I think you have, though, counsel had quoted the El Paso case and said this was dictum, and that was the case, you know, relied on by the district court. There's a case, DEK Energy versus FERC, which we cited in our brief, 248F3rd, which quotes again the same quote from El Paso that says the nub of the competitive standing doctrine is that when a challenge agency action authorizes allegedly illegal transactions that will almost surely cause petitioner to lose business, there is no need to wait for the
action. These are all commodity cases where the product being sold is the same, mm-hmm. like gas basically or energy. Mm-hmm. As soon as you get away from a commodity to a differentiated product, the concern with the admission of a new competitor into the market is not unreasonable, but it's also not apodictically clear that there will be any sales lost.
Well, and in particular in this specific case, you have very, very vague and conclusory allegations in combination with an very specific NIH affidavit, which even gives funding estimates for embryonic and adult stem cell research, which shows that actually the agency is predicting that adult stem cell research funding is going to increase even more than embryonic stem cell research over the next several years.
That's not a relevant statistic here. The question is what the amount of funding they would receive but for the allegedly illegal funding of embryonic stem cell research. It's not that the fact that it increases year over year is not relevant.
Well, but it does show, Your Honor, that it's not, you know, just the fact that there are when they are trying to say that, well, because we do stem cell research, then this, you know, maybe this, some other researcher wouldn't be able to show a competitive injury. Well, you know, actually, the agency has already stated on the record that it's planning to increase funding for adult stem cell researchers. So, to
right, but for any given year, it's fixed.
Right, right. For any the amount in the entirety is fixed.
A non-commodity case that I would point out is cited extensively, or several times, I should say, in the plaintiff's brief, and that's the ICI Investment Company Institute against the FDIC, in which the regulatory change allowed more people to come to sell securities. But it's not clear at that point that anything else was happening other than the entry of people with the potential to do this, and it's not cited in your brief.
Well, Your Honor, it is cited as one. I'm sorry, if it's not
specific. Rebutted, I mean, you know, in your brief.
Well, it is in the category of the tightly regulated economic markets, where, and banking is one of these, where FDIC promulgates regs to allow non-members of the Federal Reserve System to have relationships with firms engaged in securities work. This plainly threatens the competitive interests of mutual fund companies and investment bankers just in a way that's not analogous to a grant process.
Do we have to wait to see whether they really lost any money to these newcomers?
I think there, again, the reliance is on sort of the basic laws of economics, which because of this two-tier review grant system set up by NIH and the uncertainties, as I mentioned, you could have in 1 year, someone decides to do a human embryonic stem cell research application who otherwise would have done an adult stem cell application. I mean, there's so many uncertainties. And these particular plaintiffs just have not fulfilled, even, you know, at the outset of the case, have not fulfilled the requirements of pleading an injury in fact. There's nothing more than the speculative allegation that they're going to face increased competition, but there was no allegation of any current injury or having to even respond to potential increased competition. That's another big difference. Is if you're going to face more competitors in an economic market, it's entirely predictable that you'd have to spend more on advertising or, you know, those types of economic injuries. Whereas here,
you don't think the competition heating up to get grants will cause people to invest more in their grant applications?
I would think that every
Put them in nice binders and things like that.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, I would think every year that researchers would, you know, given how low the grant rate is, the percentage, as the affidavit went, that only 22% of grants are actually granted. I mean, I would think every year researchers would make the grant application the very best that they could. And there's nothing that requires them to act differently.
Well, now, wait a minute. Now, before the entry of new competition, it's easy enough, perhaps, to put together a slapdash, a proposal, throw it against the wall, 22% stick. All of a sudden, they're going to be facing competition from a new breed of cat.
But that would...
No genetic pun intended, right?
That would be true, though, if NIH opened its doors to any new type of research. I mean, there's no showing that this particular change actually is going to cause these grant applicants any harm or any greater harm than if NIH recognized, you know, any new type of cancer research.
Well, that's an interesting point. I suppose that does suggest it's a matter of degree as to how proximate the likely causation is.
Right, which is, I think, again, a way of distinguishing it from the economic competitor standing and the Shays case where you have one candidate spending soft money and another not. I mean,
to the extent any money is going to embryonic stem cell research, and say it's $100,000 or whatever, if that were illegal, that $100,000 would have to go somewhere else, right? If you couldn't give the $100,000 to the embryonic, that $100,000 is going to go somewhere else, or that million is going to go somewhere else.
Right.
And that's going to be
go to completely unrelated research, right?
that it's...
It could go to completely unrelated research rather than to the plaintiff's type of research.
Of course, right. And, if the plaintiffs, you know, can't show that they can get, well, as I said, Dr. Deischer hasn't even shown she's filed an application with NIH, but if Dr. Shirley has no allegations that, you know, one that can support the fact that, well, this is going to, you know, go to the second tier, there just isn't any connection there that,
you know, maybe... If you get to the second tier, do you have standing?
I think, again, it would depend. I think you certainly have a much closer case than this case, but you would still have to show that, you know, in the particular institute or center, you faced competition from...
You have to show that you would have gotten the grant, but for it going to someone else?
I am not sure you would have to, at the very outset, you would certainly have to show that it made it much, you know, less likely for you to be able to get the grant, and you'd have to show that the other applications wouldn't have been there, but for the guidelines. I mean, there were, under the President Bush executive order, there was still embryonic stem cell research going on. It was just more limited, and was limited to stem cell lines, you know, created pre-2001. And so this would, so it's not that there was no competition, but mm-hmm. It's a matter of degree.
I'm not sure I understood the relevance of that.
Well, it's just to point out that, you know, if you said the 100,000. You know, if these people weren't there, it's not, again, they haven't shown that just the guidelines alone saying now, you know, stem cell lines, as long as they fulfill all of these requirements set out in the guidelines, you can use, other, that necessarily would make it less likely for these particular plaintiffs to get an NIH grant. So... We think the district court correctly decided the standing question, and that this court therefore need not reach the merits.
If we disagree with you on standing, I'm asking the same question I asked to Mr. Hungar. What should we do?
Then it's in the court's discretion. I mean, ordinarily, if the district court hasn't reached the merits, the court often will remand it. However, there, you know, as counsel pointed out, it has been briefed, and if the court reaches the merits, we think there is a sufficient record to direct the district court to deny the request for a preliminary injunction.
Questions? Thank you, Ms. Marcus.
Thank you.
Mr. Hunger?
First of all, Judge Ginsburg, I apologize. I must have misheard your question. Dr. Rocky is, of course, a declarant on behalf of the defendants. As some of the court's questions suggested, the government's view of the standing cases is of the burden here, we think, is unduly high for the reasons set forth in our brief. Just talking briefly about the DEC Energy case, that involved a potential competition situation where there was no showing that there was going to be actual competition happening, so that's a different context. On the 28J letter, just to clarify, to make sure the court understands that correctly, Dr. Shirley does not know whether Geron has filed an application because, and this is part of our problem, the government is trying to impose an impossible burden on us. Applications for grants are confidential. No one knows who has applied. There's no way for us to know precisely who has applied. But we do know that this thing that Dr. Shirley is applying for is a response to a request for applications dealing targeted at certain subjects, including liver replacements by means of the creation of liver cells. Well, stem cell research is the key response to that type of a request, whether adult or embryonic. So it's natural, whether it's Geron or someone else, it's inevitable that he's going to be in competition with stem cell applicants.
If an application is denied and then the competition is over, some have been awarded, some have been not funded, are the identities of all the applicants then made public?
My understanding is that it's only the grants that are made public.
Only the ones that prevail.
Yes, everything else you don't know. And one other point on that.
It's the ones that prevail that would have provided any competitive harm.
Yes. ultimately. But again, even the ones that denied, I mean, if, depending on where you're ranked, if you're ranked below the ones that prevailed because in between you are a bunch of embryonic stem cell researchers, you're that much further from the line, and there is discretion to reach a little below the line, but the further are you below the line you are, obviously the less likely you are
this
to be.
This isn't horseshoes. You either get it or you don't, right?
Yes, but there is discretion at this at the final phase where they're deciding what to grant. There's discretion in the agency to say, well, this one's a little bit below, but it's at a particularly it's an area that we really think is important and we want to give a benefit.
That put that may put you in competition with that application that gets elevated, but if you but if it doesn't prevail and get any of the money, it becomes irrelevant. It's the ones that got the money that ultimately. Got what you had sought.
I think that's right.
And that were your, to your detriment.
I think that's right. Just one other point, if I may, on the way the process works. It's something of an interactive process. For instance, as the record reflects, Dr. Shirley has applied and some grants that were not accepted, he is resubmitting in response to comments from the process. Obviously, that whole interactive process is affected by who you're competing against. And again, another area in which Dr. Shirley's applications and the means by which he competes is affected by the presence of this additional class of competitors.
Is this going on all the time, or are there periodic competitions?
It's periodic. It's generally a three times per year cycle, and then there are multiple different types of grants. Like there are these targeted grants that he's responding to right now, the general research grant process, and then other subcategories.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Hunger.
Thank you,
Ms. Marcus. Thank you. Case is submitted.